We have some exciting news in that the LSHTM merchandise is now available on our website, so you can go there and purchase it yourself. We have the LSHTM Baobab Tree hoodie, which is designed by famous tattoo artist Rebecca Vincent, so well worth a purchase on that one. And all of the profits support LSHTM's COVID-19 response fund, so going to a great cause as well. You will also find our LSHTM face mask, which is approved by the WHO European Standards for Face Masks and looks pretty cool as well. So do go to the website and check out the new merch. On with the episode. Hello, welcome to LSHTM Viral Season 2, Episode 5. My name is Amy Thomas, and today I'm joined by my lovely colleagues, Naomi.
Hi, everybody. Naomi here.
And Carl.
Hi, everyone. Lovely to be back.
How are you guys doing today? Naomi, how are you doing?
Today is a very busy day. I'm actually working on a bit about how climate change affects human health, which is the topic of this entire episode, but we're going to be doing some more work around it through the Institute. So I've been mulling over the different ways that the climate affects us at an individual level.
Carl, how are you today?
I'm doing very well. I think the thing that's most exciting me at the minute is the announcement of the new Pfizer vaccine that's got a 90% success rate. So it's pretty exciting stuff. Obviously, I don't think people should get too excited because it is still going to be many months before everyone gets vaccinated. But at least there's a light at the end of the tunnel that doesn't seem to be a train.
I'm very excited.
I'm very excited. It felt like there were two kind of waves of good news happening in the last week with the president election and the vaccine. So things are looking up. So this episode was part two of looking at how infectious diseases are influenced by environmental changes. And Carl, you spoke to Callista and Martin in last week's episode and touched on some very interesting topics, including mosquitoes and rice and agriculture and all of those cool things. So when I went to speak to Chris and Rachel, who are researchers at the centre, on this topic, we wanted to talk about COVID. What do we know about COVID at this point and how the climate affects COVID? And delving into it is actually a very, very complicated area. So I just wondered if you guys had any thoughts or have you heard anything in the media about you know, how this transfer from animals to humans has impacted COVID.
I got a little distracted by Carl's cat, who's appeared on the Zoom. Sorry.
Yeah, there's a slight war of attrition
cat
going on here, yeah.
There's a cat butt.
Bellatrix really wants to purr into the microphone. I'm trying to stop her.
I think we should let her. Speaking of animals.
Yeah, Bellatrix might have quite an interesting viewpoint on this, considering we're talking about the transfer of viruses from animals to humans.
Sorry.
Will she purr for the microphone?
Yeah, will she give her thoughts on this topic?
She might do. Come over here.
Yeah, I mean, Rachel does explain that there are, of course, links between climate change and infectious diseases. I mean, there's a huge amount of body of work on this topic, but I think there is a point that Chris was making, which is this habitat disruption, our interference on populations is still quite unclear. So, yeah, that was kind of like the key takeaway. But I won't ruin too much of the episode. So, yeah, now we'll hand over to Chris and Rachel. Thanks, guys. Dr. Chris Murray is a researcher based within the Centre on Climate Change and Planetary Health at LSHTM. Chris is an ecologist with deep interests in global change, conservation and health, and generally works on problems where these key themes are connected. Dr. Rachel Lowe is also a researcher at the centre and focuses more on how environmental and other factors interact to determine the risk of disease transmission. So COVID-19 is a new virus and there's a lot that we don't know about how it's emerged and how it's likely to spread in the future. But we do know that COVID, like other diseases, originated from animals. Chris, there is evidence that climate change and other human activities can destabilize the ecology of bats and other animals. Can you tell us more about this?
Yeah, sure. So I think there's lots of examples, disease-specific examples of things like environmental change or specific aspects of environmental change, including land use change and climate, having some kind of influence on the ecology of infections, whether that's in the origin species, that is in the wildlife disease dynamics, or whether that's the interface between humans and wildlife that leads to this process of spillover of pathogens from those wildlife into human hosts. So I guess the prevailing kind of idea is that when you have these environmental changes, you're changing some aspect of the ecology in wildlife hosts. So that could be the distribution of that wildlife host. It could be the distribution of the pathogen that's in the wildlife host. So things like climate is a good example where we know that the distributional range of species is often tightly constrained by climate. So if there's a change in the climate, that can change the distribution of that animal host, and that can then in turn change the pattern of infection in people.
And Rachel, do you have anything to add to that from your perspective?
Yeah, so we're seeing that as we start transforming the land from pristine forest towards more agricultural land or even towards urbanisation, we're starting to disrupt the habitat of many species, and we can see, for example, mosquito species starting to establish themselves perhaps in forest fringe areas and bring into closer contact, for example, mosquitoes that can transmit diseases from animals to humans. And this is also putting immune populations that may be moving into these areas to work on agricultural lands or perhaps to deal with illegal mining. We're seeing more exposure of these populations to potential pathogens.
So in this regard, what do we know about COVID at this point? What do we think about the emergence and how it's related to, you know, the destabilization of animals due to climate change? I suppose there's a lot we don't know.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that's the million-dollar question right now is, where did COVID come from? And the evidence sort of linking the emergence of COVID with any specific form of environmental change is still very circumstantial. So the evidence that we do have points towards bats as the sort of definitive natural reservoir of the family of viruses that coronavirus is in, or COVID-19 specifically is in. And the idea there is that, you know, there must be some kind of contact between the wildlife reservoir and humans, but we have very, very little information about what that process has been for COVID. The evidence at the moment is that there were some samples taken in the Wuhan wildlife market where the first cases of COVID were detected. And it looks as though the area of that market where the wildlife was housed was also the area where the highest number of samples came back positive for coronavirus. That is still short of a smoking gun, I would say. There's still some suggestions that perhaps the Wuhan wildlife market was not the original place of spillover. We just don't know. So a lot of the narrative that we hear about COVID-19 and the link to environmental change is really being kind of extrapolated from, you know, a broader picture that we have about the links between environmental change and infectious disease emergence more broadly, but it's still too early to say exactly what that pathway has been for COVID.
And why is it dangerous to overstretch these relationships?
Well, I think, you know, a big part of the kind of mission of understanding the origin of diseases is to try to work out whether there are things that you can do to reduce the risk for the same thing happening again in future. So if people get the idea that, you know, for example, we know where COVID came from, the suggestion has been out there about the link with wildlife trade and wildlife markets and wet markets and things like that. And so naturally the response around the world has been, well, let's shut down these marketplaces, let's shut down this pathway of zoonotic spillover. But I think it's quite a fraught thing to do, to conclude too early in this case, particularly because the resources that it takes to do some of this stuff is really can be really large, and the costs can also be really large. So we need to think about the sort of the costs as well as the potential benefits of doing that sort of thing. So in the case of shutting down the Wuhan wildlife market, for example, you have to think about, you know, all of the broader issues in the context of preventing the possible spillover of a novel pathogen. That could be the livelihoods of people, it could be, you know, the dependencies of the people that work in the market, all that kind of stuff. If you play that out over and over and over again, you have to start building up the picture of the sort of pros and cons of doing some of these things. And in particular, when you don't have very good evidence supporting those actions in terms of the prevention outcome, then I think that starts to become a little bit of tricky ground.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really important point about, you know, where do we direct resources, and knowing, you know, where to go is really vital, especially when there's so many unknowns, and that can be quite difficult at this time. Rachel, you work obviously a lot on other diseases and looking at seasonality and climate change and how that influences infectious diseases. And some of these influences are quite clear cut, and there's a lot of evidence towards that. Do you want to tell us a bit more about that? What do we know at this stage?
Well, I work a lot on the impact of environmental change on vector-borne diseases, mainly diseases transmitted by mosquitoes, which are very sensitive to changes in the climate. And with climate change, we're starting to see milder winters, warmer summers, for example, across Europe. And in recent years, we've seen sort of increasing distributions of certain mosquito species, such as the Asian tiger mosquito. And this has also coincided with isolated outbreaks of certain arboviral diseases like dengue and chikungunya. We've also in recent years seen malaria re-emerge in Greece. We've seen more outbreaks of West Nile virus. So all this is a sort of a combination of more suitable climate conditions, which can allow new mosquitoes to establish themselves, but also a combination of international travel and trade, for example, in used tyres that can help invasive mosquito species establish themselves in new areas. But it's very difficult to disentangle the impact of, say, climate change from all these other drivers related to globalisation, for example.
And you mentioned seasonality in there, and looking at, you know, how malaria populations change in seasons, and that causing, you know, outbreaks in certain areas. What do we know about COVID and seasonality at this point? I would guess that how we might predict what COVID would act like in future years would be to do with its seasonality. What do we know about that?
Yeah, well, so COVID's a respiratory infection, and we know that other respiratory viruses like influenza and other seasonal coronaviruses, they do tend to exhibit a seasonal cycle, and they tend to peak in winter and temperate regions. It's very difficult to know exactly how seasonality will play out with COVID, partly because we haven't experienced a full annual cycle yet. It's a novel pathogen, so we have a large proportion of global population still susceptible to COVID. So it's very much this susceptibility that's going to sort of overwhelm the signal of COVID. But there is some emerging evidence that there may be some sort of weak effect between, for example, cooler temperatures and COVID, but that's very much overwhelmed by the interventions that have taken place so far, such as lockdowns and the availability of income support, which impacts how likely people are to comply with stay-at-home measures, for example.
And you mentioned that viruses similar to COVID might peak in winter or colder months. Why is that? Is that mainly to do with the susceptibility, or are there other factors at play?
Well, that's a very good question, and there's still a lot of unknowns about how, you know, where the signatures play out in influenza. So we know it's seasonal, for example. Often it's very linked to things like the school calendar. And also it's still unclear with these sorts of viruses if it's the impact of, say, colder temperatures, how that might impact the virus itself, or whether it's just related through how humans behave in colder weather. We tend to gather indoors, which of course is more favourable for the transmission of respiratory viruses.
That's really interesting. Thanks, Rachel. And I just want to come back to the point about how we frame infectious diseases and looking at COVID. You know, we're in a global pandemic right now, and you know, actually today, you know, we're kicking off the Race to Zero dialogues, which is promoting discussion around climate change. And, you know, Chris touched on this tenuous sort of link at the moment. We're trying to figure out how potentially climate change does or doesn't impact COVID. Would you frame COVID as a planetary health issue?
Yeah, I think, you know, planetary health is a sort of a fairly recently coined term to describe situations or health issues that are sort of broadly connected to planetary systems, you know, things like climate and land use and pollution and things like that, where we're talking about processes of, you know, what maintains the earth and makes a safe operating space for humanity. More or less anything that kind of connects to this interface is, you know, can really be considered a planetary health issue. COVID is an example of that, simply because of the diversity of impacts that we've seen from COVID. And at this stage, I'd say it's, you know, kind of more legitimately focused that discussion around, you know, how do we maybe use COVID as an example to inform us about the way that we might reorient our trajectory, you know, either socially, developmentally, or environmentally, to try to think about, you know, reducing these types of risks in future, but also on a whole bunch of other things. You know, COVID's presented this beautiful, if, you know, horrifying natural experiment on just how far we can go collectively to solve a global health crisis, you know, like a pandemic. Many of the same things that we're seeing with COVID could equally be argued as necessary for some other global health crises, including some of the projections around the impact of climate change, for example. So there's a lot of discussion about, you know, how can we use COVID as a sort of a model for making changes for the better, for, you know, for the sustainability on planet Earth as we continue to develop.
And Rachel, would you sort of agree with that thought process that, you know, framing the response to COVID is highlighting sort of key planetary health issues, and perhaps looking at the emergence is less about planetary health at stage?
Yeah, I think that as Chris mentioned, the response to the COVID pandemic certainly gives us an opportunity to stop and think how we can recover from this situation and think about how we can really bring climate change mitigation into our plans and start to sort of think in a more holistic way, thinking about how this pandemic has impacted, you know, multiple different health outcomes. So we have this real syndemic situation where we're seeing this whole package of the COVID epidemics. It's been exacerbated by other non-communicable diseases, and we really need to start thinking about developing more holistic responses to this huge threat, and also to take this opportunity to reduce our carbon footprint, for example, of the health sector, of many different sectors. Think about how we can manage all the waste that's been generated from this pandemic. I think it's really brought to the surface a lot of really key issues about how we can develop a more sort of sustainable and an environmentally way of living our lives.
What needs to be done now then to find out more about how COVID is linked to the environment and climate change?
I think with respect to the response, we don't, you know, in terms of capitalizing on the social sort of the social impacts that we've seen with COVID to emerge from the pandemic on a more sustainable trajectory, we don't really need to know, you know, too much more about the origin of COVID just to get that underway. And in fact, that's already happened. There's been, you know, clear support from the leaders of global agencies, health and environmental agencies, to you know, to make sure that we start taking what people are calling greener steps or a green recovery, you know, using this disruption as a sort of a catalyst for doing that. With respect to finding out the origins of COVID, you know, I want to be careful not to categorically say that there is no connection. Of course, we just don't know at the moment. We use theory from other diseases to suggest these pathways. And we know that, you know, for example, these places where humans are coming into contact with wildlife species, where there's, for example, butchering or there's trading of multiple species in the same location, there's an opportunity always for pathogens to move from one host to the other. And that's one of the sort of arguments around that connects COVID to this possible environmental degradation story. So we need both. We need to do, you know, as much as we can on the recovery, but we also need to clarify some of the circumstances around the emergence of COVID. It's been almost a year now. It's been, you know, since the first cases of coronavirus were declared to have occurred in this Wuhan market. It's been, you know, a really long time with not much update on what's really happening there. There has been an awful lot of sampling and interrogation. We need to sort of follow that science through until we have some kind of clarity about, you know, the strength of evidence that we have for certain pathways of this, the emergence of this disease.
That's really interesting. Thanks, Chris. And Rachel, will you and other researchers be continuing to look at seasonality in COVID and try and find out some of those links?
Yeah, so we're trying to find the best ways to try and identify these weather signatures, like taking into consideration all the other things that can impact the impact transmission, such as immunity, susceptibility, interventions, and trying to isolate that to see if there would be any value in using Earth observations or climate information to inform the pandemic response, and thinking about not only how winter and cold temperatures might impact COVID itself, but what about all the other winter pathogens and the big demand on the public health services during winter. And also, it's very interesting to think about how our understanding of extreme climatic events can also impact the response. So, for example, if we have storms or floods that can disrupt response efforts and displace populations, what will that mean for COVID transmission? If we have droughts, which will lead to shortages in water, what will that mean for hand hygiene? And thinking about how we can sort of manage those compound risks of extreme weather events and a COVID pandemic at the same time.
I really like that point about the control efforts, and I think, yeah, that's really interesting to hear about some of the things that you're looking at within that area, and also what you said about sort of potentially ruling out some of the environmental influences. And I guess that ties back to what Chris mentioned earlier about where do we allocate resources and making sure that we're putting efforts in the right area to prevent these kind of diseases happening.
I guess COVID, it's not so much the area that I've been working on. I was running models, as were many people interested in diseases, particularly at the beginning of the pandemic. And the thing that I think was the kind of overriding priority at that time was to be treating COVID as an epidemic, in an epidemic phase, in a pandemic phase of the disease, which would show very different characteristics to an endemic phase of disease. So the analyses that I was kind of focusing on in the beginning was looking at whether there was, for example, an impact of climate in slowing the speed of that epidemic in the context of all of these other factors that people were talking about, including the preparedness of different countries' health systems to cope with a pandemic shock or the emergence of a new disease. And the thing that I kind of got from looking at the data at that time was that when it comes to the, you know, the number of cases and in particular the number of deaths in the early phases of the pandemic, the thing that came out most strongly throughout that stuff was how quickly countries reacted to the news that they had acquired infections in their own countries. And I found a very strong story about countries acting quickly and then reducing the total number of deaths at that initial stage of the pandemic. There were other signals in there. You could see the climate signal. You could see that countries that were slightly warmer were also having slower epidemics. There was relationships with other characteristics like population density and the number of airports that your country had and all of that kind of thing. But really it was about the response at that time, I think. And I wouldn't want to sort of let the narrative of environmental change and climate change overrule the way that these epidemics unfold, which, as Rachel mentioned, was primarily driven by the availability of susceptible hosts for a completely new pathogen in the human population. And I think that's a super important message for that stage. However, as we move towards trying to understand the endemic, you know, the disease as it becomes endemic, which it seems is inevitable for this disease, which does not look like it's going away, unlike, for example, SARS, which kind of just disappeared from the human population. That's really when we're going to be able to sort of see and quantify these things like the seasonality and the net contribution of climate and climatic factors and things that are related to climatic variables like droughts and floods and things like that, in influencing the endemic dynamics of COVID. So I would, you know, broadly speaking, in my mind, sort of separate those two phases of the pandemic as being as likely to be fundamentally different. And Rachel will probably have more to add about that, I guess.
Yeah, I guess my final thoughts are that, you know, climate change is said to be the greatest public health threat of the 21st century. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic is really a wake-up call. We've managed to mobilise and, you know, respond quickly to this pandemic. But I think there's been a lot of wait and see in terms of climate change response. And I think this is really a wake-up call that governments, communities and sort of all levels of society really need to pull together and do something to mitigate against the impacts of climate change before it's too late.
Absolutely, and I guess that's where the narrative that climate change is affecting our health in all of these different ways is so important now, because people are more attuned to health and global health, and I think, you know, they have been for a very long time. So yeah, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I thought that was a really, really interesting discussion, and yeah, thank you so much.